Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Listeners, welcome to this incredible throwback edition with the amazing and incredible Annie Duke. If you're into poker, you recognize that name already. She was a World Series of Poker player, heads up champion, and now she's turned into a business consultant talking all about decision quality and improving it by embracing uncertainty. We had a fantastic conversation, and I think you're going to love this episode with Annie Duke. Hi, Annie. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm very, very well. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun conversation. I'm really excited to get into it. You know, a lot of our listeners are professional negotiators, salespeople, procurement people. We even have some police negotiators that listen. So when it comes down to learning how to make better decisions and improving decision quality, negotiation and decision quality are so interlinked that having you on the show, I think, makes a ton of sense. Plus, your book was fantastic. So congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, you write these things and you put them out in the world and you don't know if it will be a tree falling in a forest. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Wonderful. Before we get started, maybe you could give our listeners a little bit of background as to who you are, people who don't necessarily know about you, and why you wrote the book.
Oh, yeah, sure. So I started off my adult life as an academic, really with the full intention to continue down that road as an academic. So I was doing my graduate work at the University of Pennsylvania. I was studying cognitive science, which is really kind of the interplay of, it's essentially how does your brain process the world, is really the way that you could sort of generally think about cognitive science. So I was there and really focused on, in particular, learning and how people learn, particularly how little kids learn. And I was off to become a professor. So as I was finishing and off to become a professor, I got very sick. I had been struggling kind of during the last year of my work with a stomach issue that got really bad during my last year. And I actually ended up in the hospital for 2 weeks. And the 2 weeks that I was in the hospital happened to be exactly the 2 weeks that I would have been going out for my job talks to become a professor. So what that meant was that just between that and then recuperating and recovering as I was healing, I had to wait a year to go out and become a professor. But, you know, fully intended that still that was going to be my path. But during that summer, I discovered, when you're not in graduate school, they don't give you a fellowship anymore. And so I need money. born of practicality, and needing to be able to put food on the table, I started playing poker, which isn't that insane. This was in the 90s, so it wasn't on television. So it wasn't something where I could have been watching it and thinking, oh, that would be interesting, I should do that. But I happened to have, luck intervene in my life in a particular way, which is that my older brother, Howard Lederer, had actually already been playing poker professionally for about 10 years before all of this happened. And so he was the one who actually suggested, look, you know, in the meantime, while you're waiting to get back out onto the academic job market, why don't you play some poker? And I was actually recuperating. I was recuperating in Montana, which is where I was married at the time to my now ex-husband. But his family lived in Montana. So we thought, well, we'll go out to Montana while I'm waiting to go back to UPenn in order to finish. And that would be a good place to recuperate. And it just turns out that Montana is a state that had legal card rooms. And so off I went on my brother's advice to go play poker, and that's what I was going to do in the meantime, which somehow turned into 18 years. Go figure. It was a very long meantime.
You did very well, obviously.
Yeah. So I played professionally from 1994 to 2012. at one time I was the leading money winner. I was the leading money winner among women in tournament poker for a while. I won the National Heads Up Championship. I have a World Series of Poker bracelet. I won the Tournament of Champions. So, you know, I mean, I accomplished some stuff. But what's interesting is that, you know, when I talk to people, they say to me, oh, you know, you used to play poker and now you wrote this book, which is really about decision science and thinking about, you know, how do we make good decisions? And how did that left turn happen? And I say, you know, not only is it not a total left turn, because, you know, when I was playing poker, I was thinking about these issues of how you learn, and particularly how you learn when feedback is kind of noisy, right? When you can't really figure out why something happened. So I, you know, that's really what I was getting my graduate degree in, was, you know, decision making and how do we process the world. Poker is an amazing real world problem, which is just a straight application of that issue, right? You have very, very noisy data, meaning, you know, you can win a hand that you played really poorly and you can lose a hand that you played really well. And so that makes it very hard, because there's sort of a disconnection between outcome quality and decision quality. And there's just a lot of, you know, there's just a lot of variance in the data. So it's hard to sort of connect things up. And so I was applying, you know, I was sort of exercising these skills, like, in real time, trying to figure out how to solve it for this practical application. So I was doing that. And so that is not that unrelated to what I was doing in graduate school. And then actually the thing that people really don't know is that in 2002, so this is 8 years into my career, I was asked actually by a hedge fund. And, you know, I think about these lucky things that happened in my life, and weirdly getting sick turns out to be one of these very lucky things, because obviously that really changed the course of my life. Although at the time I would have told it was bad luck. I sort of consider it good luck now. But in 2002, a friend of mine, Eric Seidel, got asked to speak to a group of options traders about, you know, how poker might inform their decision making. And Eric Seidel is an amazing person who does not like public speaking. And so he said, no, but you should ask Annie, because, you know, Annie used to teach it in college. And so I'm sure she'd be fine getting up in front of a group of people and talking about this. So I took on the challenge. And I would say that was the first time that I thought about how these two things that I had done in my life at that point spoke to each other. You know, how the work that I was doing in graduate school, and then the work that I was doing at the poker table to try to figure out how you navigate that particular problem, how could I communicate to people in a way that they could really get the way that these two things really talk to each other, so that you figure out from that interplay how you could become a better decision maker and where the pitfalls were, which of course is part of becoming a better decision maker, is recognizing where the problem is really hard. So I got up, I gave that talk. That particular talk was actually about some of the ways that emotional control or lack of emotional control can get in the way of your risk management. And then from there, I just started getting referred out. The person who had that, who had asked me to come speak, Roger Lowe, just started recommending me to other people. And slowly but surely, I started building that business. And I was doing that under the radar for 10 years, you know, giving keynotes and doing trainings and doing consulting in this space. And then in 2012, I retired from poker and focused on this. So the book, Thinking in Bets, is not as out of the blue as it feels. It was actually born of, you know, all of this, you know, keynoting and consulting that I was doing, and thinking about how you communicate these concepts to people such that they, you know, could actually take something away from it and become better decision makers.
Brilliant. Yeah, in reading the book and enjoying the holy game of poker myself, it's... I find it fascinating how you've taken something like poker and decision quality and pushed the two together to make it make sense for people. And that's what I found most enjoyable about the book, is that it was so easy to read. It wasn't so over the top academic that it was difficult to consume, but super easy to read, really, really readable format. And you tied it into a whole story. And one of the unique things that I think you talk about is this whole concept of resulting, where just because you get a good result, you tend to believe that your behaviors, your habits, or decisions leading up to that result must have been good as well. when that's not necessarily true. The two can be exclusive of one another. I'd love for you to talk us through why you believe getting rid of the idea, or at least disciplining yourself to think of the results as separate from the discipline, is so important.
Yeah, so I think here's the issue, is that we as a species are what you would call sort of overfitters, meaning that, you know, we sort of look at the data and we try to sort of fit it to a story. So, you know, people have talked about, oh, we you know, where there's only correlation, we think there's causation, or we see patterns where they don't exist. That's sort of part of how conspiracy theories bloom. And what you're talking about resulting, I think, is part and parcel of this, which is taking something that shouldn't be so tightly linked together and linking it together to sort of create certainty in a relationship that doesn't really exist. So resulting in particular is this. It's saying, when I don't really know or feel like I can't know whether a decision is good or bad, because, you know, I mean, it's hard. Like, you make a decision and it's like you can't see the decision tree. You know, you can't see all the different scenarios or all the futures that might sort of result from that decision. You can't see and you can't know for sure what the probabilities of any of those futures are. This is all sort of very hidden from view. Like, we don't live in the matrix where the code is running down in front of us, so that somehow we have transparency into whether a decision is good or bad, and we can actually sort of work out the math at any moment. So this is all sort of hidden from view. So the question is then, how do we figure out, particularly in retrospect, whether a decision was good or bad? And what we do is we use a shortcut. We use a heuristic, which is what you were referring to. And what we say is, okay, I can't really, you know, in most cases, I can't really know whether a decision was good or bad, but I do know whether the outcome was good or bad. Like, so if you take poker, I know whether I won or lost the hand. And what we do is we overfit there. We create too tight a relationship between those two things. And we say, okay, I don't know whether the decision was good or bad, but if I know that the outcome was good or bad, I'll use that to work backwards. So that if there's a bad outcome, I'll assume it was a bad decision. If there was a good outcome, I'll assume that that was a good decision. So that's resulting in a nutshell. And you can see this all the time, for example, in sport. You know, particularly like when a coach of a team makes an unusual call, you know, and then it doesn't work out. Like, if, for example, in like hockey or soccer, if a coach, you know, pulls the goalie, you know, in a spot where, you know, maybe the fans don't really understand it, and then loses because of that, they're very, you know, the coach is very likely to get a lot of blame for that, for example. You know, in football, in American football, there was a very famous example of that I refer to in my book, which is in 2015, the Seattle Seahawks, the last play of the Super Bowl that year, were down by four, and they were on the other team's 1 yard line. So they had to move the ball a yard, and everybody expected them to do a run play. Pete Carroll called a pass play. The pass play ended in a game-ending interception. So the ball was intercepted and the Patriots won the game. And you know, the next day, the newspapers were saying, you know, this is the worst play in Super Bowl history. I think USA Today said this was the worst play in all of football history, the worst play call. So you can see there that what we know is that the result of the decision was horrible. It was a game-winning interception. And what everybody's doing is saying, well, now that I know that, I can work backwards and figure out the decision quality. So here's the problem with doing that. And here's why this is such a big deal. If we think about a game like chess, resulting is not actually that bad a thing to do. So like, Mark, like let's say that you and I play chess and, you know, we play a game and I lose to you. So we know that my outcome was bad and your outcome was good. What can we figure out about my decision quality versus your decision quality? Give it all you know is the outcome. You didn't get to watch us play.
Yeah, I know the answer to this one because I read the book. Because yeah. This is what I love about your comparisons is you in chess, you know all of the possible moves and everything right. is visible to you, whereas in something that's an unknown, like a football or a poker game or a negotiation, there's a lot of unknowns that that may come to light and may not come to light. And so that's what I love about this question is, in something that where all of the outcomes or all of the decisions leading to outcomes can be known, then making a good decision is a lot easier, or at least knowing whether or not your good decision is going to lead to a good result is a lot easier than in something that's as unknown as like a poker game or a football game.
Yeah, that's right. So like in cases where you're losing the stuff that causes the noise, then, you know, working backwards isn't a crazy thing to do. Right. So just as you said, I mean, there's kind of two things. I mean, not only, as you pointed out in chess, are all the pieces known, right? So you can see where all the pieces are, which means that theoretically, like if I'm considering any move, I can figure out any possible move that you can make in response because I can see what they all are because I can see where your pieces are. So that's kind of there isn't this big influence of hidden information, just information that's hidden from you. But then the other influence is there isn't luck in the same sense. So certainly like those pieces are going to stay where they are until someone moves them by an act of skill. Like nobody's just rolling a dice and they happen to roll like, you know, a nine. And, you know, if a nine comes up, sorry, your bishop is coming off the board. So we can think about those as the two main influences that cause uncertainty in this relationship between outcomes and decision quality. So like we can think about luck on its own. So for example, if I have a coin and we fully examine the coin and we've weighed it and we know that it's a fair coin. So we know for sure, we know 100% sure there's no hidden information here that the coin's going to land heads 50% of the time and tails 50% of the time. That doesn't mean that you can call the next flip with any certainty.
Right.
Right. So just because you know how often it's going to hit, you know, land tails or heads doesn't mean you know whether it's going to land tails or heads on the very next flip. So that's like the influence of luck. And so we can think about that as like, even if you had all the information you needed in order to make a really good decision, if it's the case that there are still all sorts of ways that could turn out, then there's going to be an influence of luck there, which is going to determine just where in the range of possible outcomes you occur. So you sort of land. And so that's the luck element. And obviously you can see that in poker in the sense of like, you know, I can't control the deal of the cards. Mm. Right. So we could get all of our money in and you have aces and I have fives, but there's still like, you know, two more cards to come and neither of us have any control over those cards. And sometimes a five's going to hit and you're going to be sad. Yep. So that's luck. And then the other element, and this obviously, and then we can think about how they sort of land in negotiations, right? So the other element is hidden information. And obviously in negotiations, this is a really big deal. So in poker, the cards are hidden from view. I just don't know what you have. So I the better I am, the better I am at narrowing down the things that you could have, but I can't know exactly what you have. And so in that sense, you're sort of always guessing. That's number one, because it's just hidden from view. And then number two, which I think is kind of interesting, and that this sort of like gets into the luck thing as well, is that sometimes like a key piece of information that would tell you which way was the best way to decide gets hidden from view. Like you just don't have access to it. So we can sort of put that in the category of information asymmetry. Like whenever you go into a negotiation, and poker's really just a negotiation, there's stuff that the people across the table know that you don't know. So we can then, you know, relate that. Like, even if you knew everything that the other person knew and you negotiated a really good contract, you still don't know, you know, there's still many ways that the future could turn out.
That's right.
So, right, if you're negotiating a sales contract and let's say that you just happen to negotiate like the perfect sales contract, you know, sometimes there's just not an appetite for it in the public, or there's some competitor that springs up that, you know, takes over, you know, the market, or, you know, whatever it might be. It's like, even if you had perfect information there's just different ways that things can turn out. They can turn out well, they can turn out poorly, and you don't have any control over that after the decision. But then in negotiations, you also add into the fact that there's information asymmetry. The people across the table know stuff that you don't know. And so part of our job is to figure out when something doesn't turn out well, why? what was the influence of hidden information? What was the influence of luck? What was, you know, us making a poor quality decision given the information that we had? What was us making a perfectly good decision given the information that we had that just happened to turn out on the bad end of the possible futures that could occur? And then sometimes also what, sometimes after the fact, some piece of information reveals itself to you that you didn't know beforehand. And then what you have to do is say, well, you know, now let me ask this question. Could I have known this beforehand? You know, and because sometimes we get caught up in that self-recrimination, like, why didn't I see that coming? Like, why didn't I know about that? And the fact is that the answer is very often, well, you couldn't have known about that. That was only something that was going to reveal itself later. And then sometimes the answer is, yes, you could have known about it beforehand. And then don't self-recriminate, just add it into your process going forward.
Yeah. I find that in negotiations, specifically in B2B negotiations between salespeople and procurement people, there's, you know, when either side feels like they've come to a good result, we don't do a good enough job of doing like an after-action review, even to determine, okay, what led to that good result, or prior to, I think, Daniel Kahneman calls it a pre-mortem in Thinking Fast and Slow, mm-hmm. where he says, okay, everything went wrong. What happened? Right? Like, right. How do you deal with that situation when it comes up? And we don't do a good enough job in determining what decisions we make and what habits we have or what words that we say that lead to a certain area. And so often we're left with just the result after the fact, and we're going, hey, great job, when that may not necessarily have been true. You may have just gotten lucky. And so there's a great professor out of Harvard in the program of negotiation. His name's Michael Wheeler, and he wrote a great book on negotiation improvisation. And one of the big parts of that book was around developing good after-action reviews and putting in place good pre-mortems to make sure that you're making better decisions, using the right words, asking the right questions all along the way, so that eventually you'd statistically lead out to better results without, or at least reducing the factor of luck, so to speak.
Yes. So, you know what? I'm really actually, you said something really, really good in there that I want to kind of pull out and grab a hold of. So basically you were making two points. You know, the question is, what's your sort of before decision process, right? So what are you doing to make sure that you have sort of the clearest view of what the landscape ahead might look like given any decision that you might make, right? So if you're weighing like decision A versus decision B, how good are you at the scenario planning? And then, you know, figuring out what the probabilities are of those scenarios occurring. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned in terms of your pre-planning, doing a pre-mortem, which is a great way to do it. It's so you sort of imagine whatever this has turned out quite poorly. How do we think that happened?
Yeah.
Well, you can also do something like which is called a backcast, which is the mirror image of it. Whatever it is turned out quite well, sort of, you know, better than we could have imagined, you know, why did that happen? And what that allows you to do is not get so caught up in worrying about the thing that's just on the horizon, but to get a little bit of a longer view and to start thinking about, well, you know, what are the influences of luck here? Sometimes, you know, it turns out poorly and it's because there's something that we don't have control over. It turns out well because of something we don't have control over. So let's get a clear view of what the influence of luck on this outcome is likely to be. But then also let's look at along the way where decisions, you know, where things might go sideways, and now we're thinking in advance, how are the decisions we're making maybe influencing the probability of things going sideways? What are our reactions going to be? And we're thinking about that in advance so that we're not reactive, we're nimble. And now you can create much better strategic plans when you've done this advanced work, when you've sort of examined the dead body before the patient actually dies. That's the idea of a pre-mortem. And most people teams really like to be very rah-rah and think about how everything's going to go really well. So you're putting people into a little bit of an uncomfortable place when you're doing a pre-mortem, but it's well worth your time because by doing this imagining of a bad outcome, which is a little bit uncomfortable because it feels like you're not kind of rooting for yourselves in that sense. You actually really reduce the probability that a bad outcome will occur because you have much better plans and you've anticipated a lot more where things might go wrong. So that's like that pre-planning. But right before you got to that, you said something very insightful that I really kind of want to sink my teeth into here, if it's okay.
Go for it.
Which is, what are you doing after the fact?
Yeah.
Right. And you said something I think really important. So a lot of times when I'm talking to people and they're trying to figure out like, why did things go well? You know, why did things go poorly? They'll say to me, you know, we're really process driven around here. You know, we don't care so much about outcomes. We really care about process and we're trying to make sure that our process is optimal. And that's what we do around here. And then I watch them and I realize like, no, that's not true. This is very much a do as I say, not as I do issue. Because you're not really process driven. You're actually outcome driven, but using a lot of process language. Mm. So how do I know that when I'm working with people? Well, let me ask you this. When are the all hands on deck process dives occurring? Are they occurring when there's a really good outcome, or are they occurring when there's a really bad outcome that happens, when things don't go well?
Yeah, really good point.
It's always when things don't go well. It's like, when is everybody getting in the room and trying to do a process dive about like what went wrong and was our strategy right and was our model correct and you know, how did this happen? It's always when you have some kind of bad outcome that happens, when things do not go as well, and particularly when those things don't go well in an unexpected way. So you're living in, when we do a process dive, we're going to worry about bad outcomes. That's number one. And then number two, we only ask a unidirectional question. We can think about asking questions in an upward direction. So when things go really poorly, we're all in the room saying, how could we have avoided this? Could we have lost less? Could we have actually won? You know, is there a way that things could have gone better than they did? So that's an upward direction. And people in the room aren't saying, well, maybe we should have actually lost more. You know, maybe there was some really unlucky thing and most of the time this was going to go really well. And we should have actually had a lot more resources invested in this. And this really horrible, like 0.5% thing happened. And now we sort of realize that actually this was a much better decision than we thought through this process, and we should have actually lost more. So people aren't doing that. And, you know, I think about it in this way, like let's say that you're a real estate investor and you have a group, is investing in real estate. That's what your enterprise is. And you invest in a property and the appraisal comes in low, 20% lower than you expect or 10% lower than you expect. So obviously this is like, you know, alarm bells are off and there's an all hands on deck meeting. Why? Because you're worried that your model of the world, that your model of what the market is going to deliver to you here is wrong. And if it's wrong, you want to make sure that in order for us to allocate our resources, our models, our predictions, our forecast of the future must be good. And now this appraisal's come in 10% too low. And so you become very concerned about why did that happen? So that's reasonable, right? Like I want to make sure that I've got a limited, you know, number of dollars that I can invest, and I want to make sure that I'm investing them off a reasonable model. But now let's think about the reverse, the opposite side of the thing. So the enterprise invests in a property and the appraisal comes in 10% higher than expected. Is there an emergency? Is there an all hands on deck meeting? Like how could we have been so wrong? Why didn't we see this coming? This is really bad. Why did this appraisal come in so high? No. So, and here's a problem is that if you're thinking about resource allocation, then it's just as bad if it's 10% too, you know, higher than expected as, you know, 10% lower than expected. Because if your model is off in either direction, you're not going to be allocating your resources properly.
That's right.
You're certainly not going to maximize them. But who on earth has something really good happen and says, oh my gosh, we need to have an emergency meeting where all the partners get together and have a discussion about it? Nobody does it. So when people say to me like, oh no, I believe in process and that's what I tell my employees, I say, no, you don't. No, you don't. You believe in outcomes and that's what you're telling your employees because you're only ever doing these you know, these questioning, people are only ever under the microscope when they're, when a bad thing happens.
Right.
And so you're just saying loud and clear, I care about bad outcomes.
Hey, listeners, we're going to get back to your show in a moment, but first we're going to have a word from this show's sponsor. Are you looking to build a strategic sourcing or procurement organization this year? Do you have expertise or knowledge gaps in your existing team that result in missed savings goals? Do you need help figuring out if your vendor pool is calculating your taxes correctly? If you answered yes to any of these questions, there is help. SpendLogic Group leverages decades of real-world procurement experience to drive your success. You may remember Mike Cadieux from episode 45. He's the guy that took the bold move to go from chief procurement officer to entrepreneur. Well, this is his team. Mike's team has decades of experience managing billions of dollars in indirect spend across all indirect categories. And now they want to help you. You can contact them at info@spendlogicgroup.com or call them at 800-484-0536. I have no doubt that it will be well worth your time to chat to Mike and his team. And now, back to your show. Yeah, I 100% agree with you. And I think there's, we tend to trick ourselves into believing that we, or we trick ourselves into thinking we believe one thing and not necessarily another. And that sort of leads into my next question around truth. You mentioned in your book that we as people, human beings, are prone to believe what we're told, especially if it's said with some sort of authority. And whenever we get into a negotiation, our job as good negotiators is to influence the other party, whether it be through opinion or rumor or conjecture, to get them to make a decision in our favor, obviously.
Right.
And so often we get into the emotional aspect of being caught up in this quote unquote truth cycle, where we don't necessarily do what's required to validate the information that we're being told. And so a lot of that comes down to discipline and being disciplined to make sure that we're, what's actually being said to us is factual and not necessarily opinion. Are there habits that we can develop around disciplining ourselves to get more factual information? And how do we implement that into our life? I mean, this is true for, like we see on the news almost every single day, is we don't know whether or not to believe what's being told to us. So how do we drive that discipline into our lives?
Yeah. So let me just say, just to sort of give a review of what, of part of what the problem is here, is that very often we're in the middle of anything. You know, whether it's poker or negotiations or whatever, it's like when we're away from it, we can say, here's what my goal is. This is how I'm going to execute it. You know, I'm going to be super calm. When these red flags go up, you know, I'm going to really pay attention to them. When someone's offering up information, I'm not going to accept it unquestioningly. Mm. You know, we can say all these things sort of away from the situation. But once we're in the situation, we tend not to stick to it very well. We go down a lot of slippery slopes. We sort of like, you know, we're sort of our own worst enemies. And I'm sure that everybody has felt this way. Like, oh, you know, after the fact, like, oh, why did I get so caught up in that? That was really dumb. So I think the first thing is that what we want to recognize, that as much as, you know, outside of the situation, we can think about very clearly what the road to success is. That when we're making those decisions in the moment, it's very difficult to actually stick to that. So I think that that's the first step in really getting better at this stuff. The other thing, by the way, is also to recognize how the influence of how you view the person on the other side of the negotiation is going to influence your likelihood that you think that the things that they're saying are true versus the things that they're saying are false. And overly assuming that there's, you know, talking to you in good faith is obviously an error. But also, overly assuming that they're not talking to you in good faith is also an error. I mean, so because we want to come to somewhere where it's accurate as opposed to just sort of sitting and plopping people into black and white categories. Mm-hmm. So where are we going to sort of get into the two problems? Well, one is when we feel like we're negotiating toward a common cause. When we feel like we're negotiating with the other people toward a common cause, you know, and this is going to happen in cases where you think that, you know, particularly win-win situations, like you get into lots of win-win negotiations where in some sense you sort of feel like you're on the same team, that when we feel like we're in that situation, we're very likely to default to believing everything that the other person says. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One is that there's been a lot of work, particularly like Dan Gilbert, and I discuss it in my book, which shows that we believe the things that people tell us. Partly because our abstract belief system is not really built very differently than our perceptual belief system. So, you know, what do I mean by that? Well, we can think about beliefs that we form with like our eyes and our ears and our hands, like, you know, oh, there's a tree. Okay, I believe that there's a tree because I've seen it with my own eyes. So that would be perceptual beliefs. And there's no reason to question that. You might as well just default to, yes, I've seen the tree, it must be true. But then when we think about the abstract belief system, this is the ability to form beliefs about things that we haven't ourselves experienced. So like, I haven't seen the tree, but Mark has seen the tree. So Mark comes and tells me about the tree. And we really react to that as if we've seen it ourselves, basically. So when you tell me, oh, you know, by the way, I saw a tree, I say, oh, okay, that's true too. And this is particularly true when we're speaking to people who we feel like are in our own tribe. So, you know, we're evolving on the savannah, whatever, like we're in these small kinship groups. We're human beings, so we're not particularly fast. We're not really strong. We don't have big fangs. We don't have big claws. And so the way that we defend ourselves is like we have pretty big brains and we can group together. We can cooperate. And within those tribes where we're trying to protect our resources, think about what would happen if you didn't believe the things that the people in your group were telling you. Like, what if I just assumed that the people in my group weren't telling me the truth? There'd be literally no reason to talk to them. So, like, the human beings, like, the human discourse would just sort of fall apart if we didn't assume that the things that we heard were true. So this is where we can see that when we feel like we're negotiating with somebody toward a common cause, particularly in a win-win situation, we sort of feel like we're on the same team as they are. And so we're much more likely to default to, you know, they're negotiating in good faith and they're telling us things that are true. Now, the opposite thing is true as well, that when we feel like someone is not in our tribe, where they're trying to take our stuff, right? Like they're a tribe that's in conflict with us. Now we do the opposite thing and we assume that what they're saying is not true because they're trying to take our stuff. So you can see this like in politics, right? Like Democrats believe, you know, pretty much everything that Democrats say, but don't believe anything that Republicans say. And Republicans pretty much believe everything that Republicans say, but they don't believe anything that Democrats say. So that's sort of like a, you know, in-group, out-group problem. So one of the things that we want to think about in advance is what kind of bias am I likely to sort of fall into here? Am I going to go into this and think that like we're all on the same team and we're trying to help each other and we're all sort of in good faith, like working together to try to negotiate this? Or is this really an adversarial negotiation? And if it's an adversarial negotiation, you're probably going to default to not believing what's being said. And both of them are bad. So we want to go in knowing that we're probably going to have those biases. And then what you want to do is away from the situation, you want to think about what are the things that I'm likely to do that I would like to avoid? And how can I really kind of set up contracts to make sure that I'm not doing that? So like a simple example of this kind of contract, and it's called the Ulysses contract, would be saying, these are the must-have terms that I must achieve in order to close this deal. I'm going to share this with other people on the team so that I'm accountable for it, so that they can hold me accountable to the fact that we've discussed this in advance. And, you know, these are the must-haves. And I'm absolutely not allowed to close this deal unless this list is satisfied.
Right.
And you do that in advance. You essentially set a contract with the other people in the room. And what you say to them is, if it looks like I think that maybe there's a reason that I would close it without achieving these goals, I'm not allowed to do it on my own. I have to come back and have a conversation with you guys with it. So that just sort of constrains this problem. And you can do this with beliefs as well. You can say, like, I'm not allowed to close a deal in the situation where I feel like someone's on my own team, where I have to check the facts and figures that I don't know for sure are verified. I'm not allowed to take them at my word, them at their word. And you don't need to tell them that, right? Because obviously you want it to be friendly.
Right.
But what you can say is, I've got to go talk to my team. And then you can make clear that you know in advance that this is going to be a bias, that you're going to have a bias to believing the facts and figures and information that they tell you, and taking that at face value. So you can set up contractually, you can do some time traveling to imagine that this will happen, and then put some systems in place to make sure that you're held accountable to the actions that you would like to take.
Yeah. Love it. You said something there that I found really interesting, and it sort of segues into my next question for you is, when we want to believe something, or when we believe something, we try to find facts and data to support that belief. And so you talk about motivated reasoning in your book. Can you give a description for the listeners to what motivated reasoning is and why it's so dangerous?
Sure, absolutely. So here's the problem. If we kind of go back to this idea of, you know, how do we form beliefs? And, you know, and obviously I just gave you some bad news, which is like, you know, particularly if it's coming from somebody within your tribe, you just sort of believe it.
Right.
That wouldn't be such a big problem if I then checked my facts later, right? If I did some vetting of it. And one would assume that the way that you vet a belief, like, okay, Mark told me a tree exists over, you know, somewhere else. I assume that tree exists. So now I'm walking around with the belief that there's a tree somewhere that I haven't seen. And that's fine as long as if I'm going to make any kind of high stakes decision based on the existence of that tree, that I go check it out. And I make sure it actually exists. So the way that we would presumably do that is to gather up information. In other words, to uncover information that's hidden from us. So this kind of goes back to this information asymmetry problem, right? That we don't know all the facts about pretty much anything. You know, we're across the table from someone. They know stuff that we don't know. And presumably, we should be better. We should actually create more accurate beliefs the more information that we uncover. That would be ideal. I uncover a piece of information, I look at it objectively, I say, okay, now I can incorporate this into my worldview, and voila, my belief is now accurate because I've gone and checked and seen if the tree is actually there. But what actually happens is that it turns out that our beliefs have a huge influence on our information processing. So when information comes in, when we come across information, we don't evaluate it with an objective eye. What we actually do is we evaluate it basically with the motivation, with the purpose of affirming the things that we already believe. So, you know, as an example, like let's say that you're somebody who thinks that gun control, if there's gun control measures in place, it will lower crime. So let's just imagine that you're somebody who holds that belief. That's obviously a really strong belief. It's very strongly political. You probably feel that that belief is very high stakes. Now, what happens is that there's all sorts of information out in the world, and you don't look at that information in an objective way. You actually do two things. One is that information that will confirm that belief for you, that supports this opinion that you have, say that gun control lowers crime, you're much more likely to notice than information that doesn't confirm the belief you have. So, you know, as you're sort of scrolling through Twitter, you're noticing the stuff that agrees with you, and you're not noticing so much the stuff that maybe disagrees with that belief. So that would be confirmation bias. And so, you know, we're doing this all the time in our lives. I mean, there's a very simple example that I give in my speeches. It's actually in my book. I always ask people in the audience, like, how do you think that a man, how do you think you predict if a man's going to go bald? And, you know, they say, aha, I know, you look at the mother's father, you look at the paternal grandfather. And I say, oh, really? So like, you know, what's your evidence for that? And always somebody will say, you know, I know, like either like if they're going bald, well, my grandfather was bald, or like, I know a guy who's bald and his grandfather was bald. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. So you're noticing examples that support the view that you have. And they are sort of like, yeah. And I'm like, so are you collecting examples like of places where a guy has a full head of hair and like, you know, his maternal grandmother is bald? Well, no, I'm not really, not really seeing that, you know. Have you ever seen it, like a case where the guy's bald and the maternal grandfather has a full head of hair? Like you're just not noticing the stuff that doesn't agree with the thing that you already believe. And we do this all the time. So that's the first problem. That's confirmation bias. So I notice the stuff that I like. But the other problem is that even when someone puts the information in front of you, says, look, you have to pay attention to this. Here's a study that says that gun control does not have an effect on crime. So let's just say that. And we know like that study exists somewhere, right? So now someone sticks that in front of you. What do you do with that? Well, what you do is now you work really hard to disconfirm the evidence. So there's an asymmetry that happens, right? Like someone says, here's a study that shows that gun control measures lower crime, and you sort of glance over it, give it a little skim, and you say, aha, that's so true, and you strengthen your belief about gun control. But now someone puts a study in front of you that says, no, gun control doesn't have an effect on crime, and you like literally read every single word, pick it apart, and write a dissertation about why the study is not methodologically sound, and they didn't run the right statistical analysis, and their N was really small, and besides, the author is biased and was probably paid for it by the NRA, right? So we do this, like, literally, we do this all the time, right? Like, even if you think about, like, if you happen to come across the guy who's got a full head of hair and his maternal grandmother, his maternal grandfather's bald, they're like, ah, that's just an outlier. Like, that's not, you know, you just sort of dismiss it. Like, you figure out a way to discredit the evidence. Okay, so that's what motivated reasoning is this circularity that, you know, I believe X, you know, so therefore that changes the way that I process information. And you can imagine, you know, in a negotiation, this would be really problematic for two reasons. On a macro level, if you believe that you have a particular strategy that's really good, and the strategy that you use in negotiations is obviously going to be very woven into your identity, you're going to notice the times that the strategy worked out really well, and you're going to tend to figure out a way to discredit the times that the strategy didn't. So you're going to do both things at once. And so you can imagine that on a macro level. And then on a micro level, if you believe certain things to be true about the world, for example, say, you know, what the size of the market is for, you know, for example, that you're going in to negotiate about, you're going to be, again, looking for evidence that confirms that and, you know, discrediting evidence that doesn't confirm the belief that you have, maybe even evidence that comes out of the other side's mouth. So now we say, all right, so obviously this is a disaster. Like, you know, this is like the grayest cloud ever, but maybe there's a way to fix it because this is so great because Mark and Annie have now had a conversation about this. And so now I'm going to be better at it because I know that motivated reasoning happenings and also, you know, happen. And I'm also really smart. So now I'm not going to do it anymore. And this is where the news gets much worse.
You're not filling my listeners with hope, Annie.
No, I'm such a black cloud. It's so horrible. But you know what the thing is? You have to have a clear-eyed view of this stuff to get any better at it is the thing. So this is where it gets worse, which is that being smart actually makes this worse. And there's been lots of studies that have shown this. So for example, Dan Kahan has done a lot of work out of Yale. And he's shown that people who are really good with statistics are also much more likely to interpret those statistics in a way that support a strongly held belief they had. So the study is really simple. It's like he shows a bunch of people statistics on whether a skin cream cures psoriasis. He figures out who's really good at reading those data tables. And now he's got people divided up into like, you're really good at reading those data tables to figure out if the skin cream cures psoriasis or you're not so good at it. So he's got them divided up into two groups. And now he gives them like literally the exact same data tables, but now it's the relationship between gun control and crime. And he knows what the person's prior belief is. And it turns out that that prior belief interferes with the ability to read those data tables objectively more for the people who were better at doing it when it was about skin cream.
It still leads them astray.
But worse. I mean, that's the thing. That's the thing that you need to know. It's worse for the people who were good at it with the skin cream than for the people who weren't. So that's like one example. Another example is there's just a lot of data. Actually, in my newsletter this week, I talk about this. There's a lot of data showing that people who are science literate, who like know a lot about science, are much more likely to engage in reasoning about science that confirms beliefs that they have about, like, you know, climate change or fracking or, you know, whatever the emotional, like, obviously there's a lot of very emotionally charged beliefs that you can have. And the people who are very literate in science are much more likely to sort of argue the science to fit their point of view. So, you know, that we see that. And we also see this like with logic problems. So you can kind of think about, okay, so why is this happening? Why is it that smart people are actually worse at this? And we can think about a variety of reasons. One is that a lot of the way that we communicate with other people is to sort of be our own best PR agents, right? To make ourselves feel good about ourselves. And one of the ways that we feel good about ourselves is that we feel that the view that we have of the world is correct. It's right. And the smarter we are, the better we are at doing that PR, because we're better at constructing arguments. We're just, you know, we're more articulate, and we can slice and dice the data in a way that supports us. Because the fact is that if you tell me, like, go find a bunch of data to support the argument that gun control lowers crime, I can go do that. And if you say, go find a bunch of data that shows that there's no relationship between gun control and crime, I can also do that. And I can come back to you with a good argument. And the more literate I am and the more articulate I am, the better I'm going to be at doing that. That's number one. Number two is that when we think about somebody who's really good with numbers or really, you know, mentally agile, they're probably more likely to think that their intuition is excellent. So we have a much higher opinion of our gut and our intuition about things that we're really good at. Mm. Right. So I know for me, you know, my gut about what the right play in hockey is would be quite poor. But I feel like I know a lot about what the right gut reaction in poker would be. So I have a lot of confidence in my own intuition and things that I feel like I'm good at and experienced at. And we know that the belief is going to drive what your intuitive response is, right? Like if I don't want to believe that gun control actually lowers crime, then I'm much more likely to sort of just glance at the data. And my intuition, my gut's going to be confirming my belief and telling me, oh, this data shows that there's no relationship between gun control and crime. And because I feel like I'm statistically agile, I'll just sort of go with that. And I'll be like, yes, my gut is great. So I have more confidence in my gut. So that's kind of number two. And then number three is that, you know, sometimes you can sort of think about what is someone's sort of skin in the game. And in the case of something like climate change, for example, I don't need to be that accurate about climate change, because as one individual, I probably can't really have much of an impact on policy. But I can have an impact on signaling to you that I'm a member of your tribe. Mm. So I get to sort of signal to you that we hold the same beliefs and that we're part of the same tribe. And if I give you the wrong signal, maybe you're going to ostracize me. So there's pressure. A lot of like social capital in there. And so people who are really, you know, really good at this stuff are likely to sort of argue toward the conclusion that the tribe would sort of approve of, because it's serving more of a social function and rather than a truth function.
Brilliant.
So that's all bad news. I just gave you a lot of bad news.
Well, I mean, and you touched on a bunch of things there that we could like really dig deep into, like system one and system two thinking and how that all works. But I know you don't have all day, and I've already kept you longer than I should. I do have one more question though. If you were going to leave the listeners with three tips on how to improve their decision quality, what would you tell them?
So the first thing I would tell them is, when you're thinking about your own beliefs or your predictions about the way that the world will turn out, try to frame it as like, would you be willing to bet on it? Because, you know, what we know is that, I mean, if you go back to what I just said about like, what's your skin in the game? Is it social capital or is it something else? Because if it's social capital, like whatever, like there's kind of no consequences to you declaring the wrong belief. I mean, not in the short run. In the long run, we don't want to walk around with bad beliefs, but maybe in the short run, you're getting something out of it. So what, you know, what happens when somebody, I mean, you can think about this for yourself, right? Like if you were to declare a belief to me, like, I think that, in 2020, whoever the Democratic candidate is going to get over 300 electoral votes. So let's say that you said that to me in some kind of way where you just announced that was, you know, this is what I think. I can create a consequence to you by saying, oh, well, do you want to bet on that? And the minute that I say that, like, think about what that does to you. Like, I guarantee you what will come out of your mouth is, well, I didn't mean for sure. Mm. I wasn't saying definitely. Why? Because I've sort of solved the skin in the game problem. I've told you that your opinions matter, and that when you say things as black and white, true or false, which is a pretty bad representation of the world. If we go back to this idea that there's lots of luck in the way that things turn out, there's, and certainly as we get 2 years away, there's a tremendous amount of luck. And there's hidden information. There's things that you might not know, that it's very hard to say anything for sure, like 100% or 0%. And most of the beliefs that we have, we should hold somewhere in the middle, you know, somewhere in between. And when I say to you, do you want to bet? What I'm doing is essentially reminding you of that, which causes you to go through, if we think about that belief formation problem, right, that we tend not to go through that step of vetting it, of going, walking over to see if the tree exists. If I say to you, oh, there's a tree over in that park, because I'm just repeating what you've told me, and someone says, do you want to bet? What do you think I'm going to do? I'm going to actually walk over and check to see if it actually exists now. So it makes me say to myself, well, hold on a second. I just said that I was sure of this, but how sure am I actually? And it switches your frame from, are you sure, to how sure are you? And this is like, it's not for nothing. I mean, it sounds like really subtle to shift from, am I sure, to how sure am I? But how sure am I makes it so that you don't have to answer yes or no. If I say to you, are you sure, you say yes or no. But if I say to you, how sure are you? You're like, you know, pretty sure, somewhere in between, maybe 70%, something like that. And it makes you start going through and saying, well, hold on a second. Like, how much luck is going to influence this outcome? You know, what do I not know? What is the person challenging me to the bet know that I don't know? Have I actually gone and checked? Have I actually gone and looked at that tree? Because if I haven't gone and looked at that tree, why am I saying this with such certainty? Like, maybe I should go, you know, maybe I should actually go vet this. And now I have to think about, like, what's the reliability of Mark? Does he have a reason to lie to me? Does he have the location right? Like, really, what is my certainty around this? So that's the first tip that I have, is start to try to think about this frame of, like, do you want to bet? Like, move yourself into the place, instead of asking the people around you and also yourself, are you sure? Start asking, how sure are you? Which is, like, a really big difference. Then the second big tip that I have is, don't do this alone. Because our minds, you know, you remember, like, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Like, there was a commercial that used to be that. But the thing is that, like, our minds just lead us astray. Like, these biases are really, really powerful. It's very hard to see them in ourselves. We have big blind spots to our own biases. You know, when people are arguing, you know, about climate change or fracking or whatever it is for their own beliefs, like, they're not actually trying to mislead anybody. They're actually just misleading themselves, because they think they're arguing in good faith. They think that they've formed this belief in a really orderly way. And we're just not really aware of a lot of the stuff that's going on in our brains. But if you think about it, we're pretty good at seeing when other people have gone astray. And in fact, so much so that there was actually a really great study by a guy named Emmanuel Troost. And this is what he did. He said, okay, I want you to solve these logic problems. And he had people write down their answers to logic problems. And then he had them rate them, you know, and people were like, my answer to this logic problem is amazing. And then he brought them back later and he gave them 5 answers to those logic problems that were written by, you know, other people, and asked people to rate them. But one of the 5 answers was actually an answer that they themselves have written. So of the people who didn't recognize that it was their own answer, which is about half of them, half of those people gave their own answers really, really bad ratings. And these were answers they were very proud of, you know, before. Because you're just better at sort of spotting the flaws in other people. And we all sort of know this, right? So the idea is, okay, if we know we're pretty good at spotting the flaws in other people, then, hey, why don't we get other people to spot our flaws?
Yeah.
And so, like, go find some people who are willing to engage in this journey with you and kind of change the way that groups usually work. Because groups tend to default to, you know, we all have heard about groupthink, and we certainly are hearing a lot about echo chambers right now. And that's kind of the way that group cohesion goes, right? Like, cohesion means, like, we all agree and we're all really smart and you're really smart and I believe the same things that you do. But you can also form a group around the principle that, like, we're actually trying to make each other better decision makers, and we're trying to spot each other's flaws, and we're trying to figure out when we're not being logical or when we're not seeing things from other perspectives. and imagining that the world could be a different way than we actually think it is. And we're all going to join together and we're going to help each other out and we're going to form a group to do that. And we're going to hold each other accountable to, you know, a more rational process. We're going to hold each other accountable to being open-minded to other people's beliefs. We're going to hold each other accountable to not declaring things as yes or no, but thinking about things as in between, you know, as how certain are we, as opposed to are we certain? And that's what we're going to do for each other. And then, you know, the third thing that I would say is use that group to hold you accountable to what your best laid plans are. So when we were talking about Ulysses contracts and, you know, imagining, for example, like here are the must-haves that I will not walk out of this room with, you know, unless I get these terms, you know, work that with the group and make the group hold you accountable, because otherwise what can happen is that in the room you come back and you say to whoever, yeah, I mean, I know that I was supposed to, you know, get this particular price, but I could tell, like, because I have such good intuition, I could tell it wasn't going to go that way. And so I had to actually settle for less. And generally the people are like, yeah, you're pretty smart. Like, I'll go with your intuition. But if you've actually created a contract that says, I'm not allowed to break this without talking to the group, and now you say, well, I saw something in the room that changed my mind, they're not going to challenge you on it. You know, and say, what makes you think that your intuition is so good? You know, my intuition isn't very good. You better justify that to me.
Yeah.
You better tell me why you broke this contract that I was supposed to hold you accountable to. And what that does is it just makes it less likely you're going to break the contract, because your standard for breaking it now has gone up so high because other people are going to hold you accountable to it.
Fantastic.
Those are my three pro tips. That's it.
Fantastic. I love it, Annie. Thank you so much for the knowledge that you've shared today. Having you on the show was a great pleasure for me, because I really enjoyed your book, and obviously I'm a fan as well in terms of your poker career. So thank you very much for being here. If you were going to direct the listeners to a place where you can share more online with online social profiles, where would you direct them?
Yeah, so the first thing I would say is that I send out a newsletter every Friday. And you can find me, you can find that at annieduke.com, and you can look at archives of the newsletter to see if you like it. Basically what I do is I go through and I look at sort of the science, you know, that's out in the world and things that are happening in business and in politics, and say, here's how you kind of apply these kinds of thinking principles and reasoning principles to sort of what's happening, you know, this week. So you go to annieduke.com, the newsletter's right there. You can read old, you know, versions of it. And then if you like it, you know, hopefully you'll subscribe. I really love communicating with people and having readers get in touch with me. I get a lot of readership of the newsletter who gets in touch with me, but there's also a contact form. If you have any questions or you just want to reach out and say hi, you can do that through annieduke.com as well. So that's place number one. Place number two is Twitter, where I'm incredibly active. So you can always find me on Twitter. I post stuff. I do my own Twitter. So hopefully you'll like what I post on there, and you can go find me there, and that's at Annie Duke. And then the third place I'd really love people to go look to find me is at howidecide.org.
Love it. And for the listeners, just so that you know, I will link out to all of Annie's social profiles, as well as her website, as well as How I Decide. Once again, Annie, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a great pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go onto iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get, because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.